This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
I am delighted and proud to introduce him as Academy Award winner.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
The winner. It's a tie.
And any little girl who's practicing their speech on the telly, you never know.
Mom, I just want an Oscar.
I am Katie Rich. I'm here with Richard Lawson.
Hello.
With David Canfield.
Hi.
And with Rebecca Ford.
Hello.
This week, we're going to look at some of the Oscar crafts categories that have our attention, not trying to make predictions there just yet, but highlight some things we're interested in. We're going to look at some of the movies that are out there to see right now, like The Killer now on Netflix, and how some of them have been faring at the fall box office. And then we're starting to get like little hints of the last couple of movies available on the fall calendar. As always, we're waiting for the strike to end as we record this, but we don't have much to say other than we hope that they get a fair deal soon and we can get back to it. Living in uncertainty is driving us all mildly crazy. But there is an uncertainty that will sort of get resolved this week. The Iron Claw, the Sean Durkin movie from A24, is going to have its premiere in Dallas this week. As we record, it hasn't happened yet. The review embargo does not go up for a while, but I think we'll start seeing some social sentiments. And I think the biggest mystery of this, I'm still rooting for Zac Efron's comeback and for Sean Durkin to finally get the big platform he deserves. But I think whether or not this is an awards movie at all, it's still kind of a mystery to all of us, right?
Very much so.
Yeah. I mean, it has the sort of patina of that, both because it's a respected filmmaker who's maybe working on a bigger scale than he has before. That's always an interesting Oscar narrative. It has, certainly in Zac Efron, a sort of teen actor who's now become, getting serious, kind of like, a comic actor going serious. It's worked for Robin Williams. It's worked for lots of other people. And it's like I don't think it's a rousing sports movie, but it is a sports movie, and so maybe has a broad appeal in some ways. And it's based on a true story. So I feel like that's all awardsy, but I don't really know if it's being positioned that way. I can't really tell how A24 is kind of running it.
Wait, but are all the muscles not an awards tactic as well?
Yeah, they added Best Muscles as a category finally in time for this one.
Mm-hmm. I wrote about 10 letters a year to them. Finally, they relented.
Just in time, too.
It was after I saw Cynthia Erivo's arms in Widows. I was like, come on, we got to have a category for this.
Attention must be paid.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's like one of the last standing sort of mysteries of the season. Is this an awards movie or not? And, we'll know in a week. I think we can update it next week. But
yeah,
to me, on paper, it definitely seems like it. But, the way they're releasing it, the way they skipped the festivals, maybe because it wasn't done, but the way the reviews are being held till right before release, there's a lot that makes us kind of wonder what the plan is here.
A few people who are working on the movie have told me some version of, remember, it's a Sean Durkin movie. Mm-hmm. And the first thing that I go to with that is really uncommercial, which makes the whole rollout that we're seeing especially interesting to me, because it feels like it's being positioned in a way where they're hoping it makes a lot of money and that it actually generates a lot of word of mouth, which for all the elements that Richard mentioned, it absolutely should if it's good. Mm-hmm. So part of me wonders if it's just like, this is a director who brings a really particular sensibility, working with a company that knows how to make those kinds of directors hit auteurs in a way, and with a kind of movie that, and a subject matter with a cast that can break out. And maybe that is the priority for them. Maybe there is a belief that if the film really hits in that way, then awards will follow. So that's kind of how I'm seeing it right now.
Yeah, I think the Sean Durkin of it all is interesting. He's a filmmaker that I think we all really like on this podcast. He hasn't worked much. He did Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene, you know, 12 years ago. Then he did some TV stuff in the UK, I think, and then came back with The Nest a few years ago. I think that both are great movies. I think a complaint would be, well, the mood is really there and the performances are good and it looks great, but nothing really happens. You know, Martha Marcy mm-hmm. has this real, you know, ends on a huge note of ambiguity. The Nest is very internal, psychological. I mean, Carrie Coon does bury a dead horse, but like, you know, that's like the biggest moment of action in that film. I mean, I still think it's a really great look at greed and family and stuff, but with The Iron Claw, something does happen. This is a true story. It's a terrible true story, like, you know, a tragic true story, as I understand it. I haven't read too much about this wrestling family, but I know it is, you know, bad things happen. So maybe that kind of Sean Durkin lending his really formidable style to a narrative that is perhaps bigger than his past narratives, maybe that's a winning combination.
A24 has obviously made hits out of really dark stuff before. It's, you know, it's something that, David, when you talked to Ari Aster before, is like he was counting on for Beau Is Afraid, and then it turned out that this was the year for it. But I really wonder about a dark Christmas movie and what that might look like, because this Christmas season is really pretty empty compared to what we've had before. And like, sort of due to the strike, but also sort of not. It's really Aquaman kind of like out there. And then Wonka opens up a couple weeks before that. There might be some bigger stuff I'm not thinking of. But I just like, I wonder about like Christmas counter programming in a year like this that feels kind of thin. Like, is that a path that we just haven't seen before?
Yeah, just the fact alone that they're going wide with a Sean Durkin movie over Christmas is very notable and very unusual in a lot of ways. And I would think that they see some kind of opportunity there because of all of that. I mean, Color Purple, I think, is the big, splashy, relatively joyful Christmas release that I'm sure Warner Brothers is hoping brings a lot of people out, you know, regardless of the strike. But this movie scratches a very different itch. My main concern for it is December is just going to be really crowded with awards contenders. Not saying this is one in general, because a lot of things have pushed. So December, you have, in addition to movies like All of Us Strangers, which were already dated for December, you have American Fiction moved to December, Poor Things moved to December, Maestro is hitting Netflix in December. Like, there's a lot of movies that are going to be competing for that attention, which, again, could explain why Iron Claw is trying to find its own lane, as opposed to just being thrown in with all of these movies that are jockeying for a similar kind of audience.
This also made me remember that there's that movie, The Boys in the Boat, coming out at Christmas.
Yes, I was just thinking about that.
Which, on paper, I think we had all said, oh, this might be a contender. George Clooney's directing it. You know, it's another true story. It, again, seemed like a possible contender that also skipped all the festivals and all of that. But we have all heard sort of through the grapevine that it's not, and it is, again, probably just a commercial play, which is the, I feel like, buzz phrase of the season this year.
Yeah.
So I think there's a couple of those films coming around Christmas that we have to kind of keep an eye on.
I mean, I did try to lend my dad a copy of The Boys in the Boat that I got, and I haven't read it yet, but I was like, oh, this might be something you'd like first. And he was like, oh, I already read that. Don't worry about it. I was like, ah, now I see the target audience for this Christmas release.
From what I understand, even about the holdovers, and we can talk about that doing really well so far, the initial campaign behind that was focused really trying to sell it in a more commercial way than they sold their last big awards contender, which was Tar, and which was a pretty significant box office disappointment.
Yeah.
So I think that is the buzzword of the season. I think that there is a renewed focus on these movies actually making money, because where maybe, and I'm not saying these, you know, departments or worlds were taking anything for granted, because these are always harder movies to sell to audiences. But that built-in specialty audience that existed before COVID for a movie at a certain critical threshold with a certain, you know, awards pedigree would do well in limited release. It would make a good amount of money almost always if it hit those marks. And that doesn't happen anymore without a much more specific kind of strategy. And so the hits that we've seen this season, whether it's like releasing Past Lives in June out of the fray, getting it that giving it that room to find an audience, which was really successful. Or, you know, different kinds of limited platform rollouts for different movies. You know, every rollout's a little bit different now. Just speaks to the fact that there is a lot more consideration for how to get people to see these movies than I think there was a few years ago, just given the way the market has changed.
Well, and how to get people to think about them. Like, I feel like the shadow of the Fablemans was looming really large when Killers of the Flower Moon came out, because the Fablemans had won that award at Toronto, and then it kind of opens to actual audiences and really, like, underperformed. And honestly, I'd be interested in looking back and seeing like what that actually looked like. And I think we talked about this, the Killers of the Flower Moon kind of like did well enough to skate by. Like, it cost a ton of money. I don't think it's going to be some like huge financial success for them. But like, I think last fall was really sobering for all these movies and being like, well, like, if people talk about it as a flop, like, it's just gonna be dead in the water. You know, they delayed the release of Women Talking for a long time, so that it was kind of like out of that fray. And I'm interested in the lessons that we're seeing from that this year. And also how little it matters when you've got two massive hits that will be Oscar nominees no matter what.
Yeah. I mean, Women Talking did not make a lot of money, but it was nominated for Best Picture. And it didn't get hit in the way that other movies did because of when it was released. And I think it also platformed over some crazy storm, and there were a lot of, you know, defense. I don't know why I'm remembering that now, but, you know, but even something like that and, you know, an extraneous event can help in terms of a narrative, and those narratives do matter.
So what other movies do we think besides Barbie and Oppenheimer can be benefited from a box office narrative based on what we've seen so far?
Well, I feel like the other big movie in that regard is The Color Purple, which we haven't seen yet, and which we don't know how it's going to do. But that feels like a movie whose fate, and I'm assuming it will be decent, you know, I'm assuming it'll be solid, could go either way, you know, on that scale, but kind of in that area. I think its awards trajectory would be determined to some extent by how well it does, because if it's a real phenomenon with audiences, it could take on a life of its own as an awards contender in the same way even Barbie did. I mean, I don't think Barbie was a movie we were really talking about as a Best Picture lock until it was clear how big this thing was going to be.
I mean, I suppose one would have to say, what about the third biggest movie of the year? I mean, bigger than Oppenheimer, Super Mario Brothers.
Yeah, like, look.
You know, in animated. I don't know if the movie itself is of quality enough when you have it up against, you know, Miyazaki, for example. But yeah, I mean, I think that the box office metric, this is something we were talking about all the way back from the Hurt Locker, you know, no one's seeing this Best Picture winner, you know, that kind of thing. I don't know how much it matters, except in this singular year, when I don't think that this season is predictable exactly. But the big, big question is just how much is Oppenheimer going to win, and maybe how much is Barbie going to win? You know, we're going to talk about technical categories later on this episode, and I think Barbie obviously stands pretty strong in those. But, you know, for me, I've sort of spent years hemming and hawing about like waning interest in movies from audiences. And I think that is true. And that contributes to box office. I mean, you know, back in the old days, Best Picture nominees, usually from studios, yes, would like actually make a good deal of money. You know, not all of them, not Merchant Ivory stuff necessarily, but, you know, Zemeckis movies and whatnot. But I also think that there is maybe a finger to be pointed a little bit at studios and marketing and a lack thereof. And I talk to so many people who are not too far from, you know, culture center, and they don't know when movies are out. You know, they no one knew the holdovers was out in theaters in New York, you know, recently. And so I don't know. I appreciate that A24, going back to Ironclaw, does at least seem to be trying to do some kind of notable rollout, you know, and I would hope they're advertising on ESPN and wherever else people who like sports are tuning in, you know, and because like I think that some effort might be required beyond, you know, a trailer release and some festival reviews, and that's it.
One other interesting narrative, this is not a typical box office narrative for awards, is for Anatomy of a Fall. Because that movie was a huge hit in France and I think is selling well internationally, generally, like really well. I believe it was the biggest Palm opening in France in well over a decade when it was first released there. And if you think about the Academy and its ever expanding global reach and makeup, I wonder what that kind of impact has on a movie like that, because it did fine in the U.S. It was, you know, for a specialty French movie with some awards buzz, it made some money, but hasn't done spectacularly well. But given how big of a global hit it is, that may have some kind of impact. It's kind of a fresh question, given how fast the Academy has changed and how rarely I think you see that, at least for international awards contenders. So that's an interesting question that I don't really know the answer to.
Yeah, I had no idea it was such a big... It's made $12.5 million worldwide. I did want to shout out Priscilla, which is newly released, and our friend and future guest, Joe Reed, pointed out that it's the first time Sofia Coppola has ever had a film in the weekend top five, ever, which might say more about context and release strategies and everything like that. But, you know, it made $5 million. It's doing okay out there. I think we've all been a little bit curious about how it's going to fare, given that it's got a little bit more of a mixed response than some of these other films. But maybe there's a box office path for it.
It does feel like there's a lot of awareness for that film. And I don't know if that has to do with the fact that the actors could be out there, that it's an Elvis story and all of that, or even the sort of controversy that's come out around it. But I do feel like that's a film that a lot of people sort of outside of our little realm even seem aware of more than I expected.
When you have good hair and makeup, sometimes they'll take you a long way. Maybe that's a category we'll get into later on.
It gives me some hope, and I'm really closely watching how movies like American Fiction and Saltburn do. Those are both Amazon movies. They're both really audience-friendly movies. They've been cleaning up at audience awards, in fact, or at festivals around the country. And they're movies that should be able to break out theatrically. And obviously, they are immediately limited by the fact that their actors can't do press. Saltburn is opening very soon. American Fiction would have opened already, I believe, and is still opening relatively soon. But I wonder what movies like that have a real commercial bent, that are also really well made, thoughtfully made, what kind of crowd they can find, given that we are seeing some hopeful signs with movies like Priscilla and Holdovers.
I mean, when I think of like bringing screeners to my family and like what I can recommend to members of my family who actually want to see movies, American Fiction and Holdovers feel like such slam dunks. Like, those are movies that even if people wind up seeing them at home, which I think is what happens to a lot of these, like, those are going to do well just because so many different people are able to see them and engage with them. And that has to be an advantage, I think.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Well, to go back to movies that may not get seen in the theater because they're already on Netflix or will be shortly, David Fincher's The Killer is going to be on Netflix as of this weekend. NIAID premiered there last weekend, so the Netflix award slate is kind of starting to go streaming. I think we've all been a little curious about where The Killer is as an awards thing. You know, Richard, when you saw it at Venice, I feel like you were not the only one who was a little bit, not iffy on it, but just kind of like did not necessarily see it as part of this conversation. And I don't think that's changed for you at all since then.
I think it's fair to say I was iffy on it.
Okay.
I mean, I think it has a couple great sequences, one involving Tilda Swinton that
every sequence she's in is great by default. So
yeah. Exactly. And so that's worth checking out for those couple of moments alone. But, you know, it's interesting at Venice, I think, because this sometimes happens, a movie that's smaller in scale than people were expecting or hoping gets a bit swallowed up by all the festival pomp and circumstance. And then when it eventually comes out a month or so later, or a couple months later, or the next year, it has a little mini reassessment from critics and people who see it, you know, right when it's out. And that seems to be happening with Killer. I've seen a lot of people kind of pushing back against reviews like mine from Venice, saying, like, you guys kind of missed the point. And, you know, it's kind of the bad kind of festival fever in a way, you know. Sometimes that particular sickness can work in the negative for a film.
Festival flu.
Sure, there you go. But let's not evoke any more modern illnesses than flu. It's not festival COVID, okay? But like I think that's interesting, and it makes me want to rewatch the movie more just like for my own enjoyment, and not, you know, in a sort of critical or work capacity. Because, you know, it's a Fincher film, and there are ideas there, there's style there that I think make it worth a watch. But no, it's not Fincher making something big and declarative like maybe he did with Zodiac or Social Network. This is a smaller, kind of even smaller in some ways than Panic Room kind of movie that, you know, he's good at those little genre exercises as well. And that's kind of what The Killer is to me, though, yes, people have post-Venice started to see, I think, some grander meaning in it.
Yeah, I feel like if you go in with the right expectations, you could really enjoy that film. I saw it and didn't really know what kind of Fincher movie I was going in for. Richard and I were texting about, there's a fight sequence in it that is really, really incredible. And again, probably worth watching just to check that out. And obviously a lot of the craft is really impressive, and performances. But it's just smaller and quieter than I had anticipated. So it might do really well on Netflix. I think it remains to be seen what we're talking about for awards.
Yeah, it's maybe a trite thing to say about Fincher's directorial style, but, you know, there are a lot of reports out there that in certain projects, he does a lot of takes per scene, you know, like sometimes in the dozens. And watching that fight scene, which is so intricately choreographed and moves between rooms and it just involves a lot of like props and sort of like crashing through things. And I was like, did that take 3 months to film? Because like, I can't imagine having to do like so many different takes of all these different setups, you know. Maybe it was filmed a lot more fluidly, easily than that, but it is very impressive as a sort of centerpiece of the movie. I think that maybe I was hoping for more of that energy sustained throughout the film.
Yeah. The sound design is really incredible within that scene and the way the choices he's made throughout the film. So I think film nerds will still find a lot of things to appreciate about it.
It's fascinating to me that this and Next Goal Wins are the first movies Michael Fassbender's really been in several years. He's been kind of out there like racing cars, I think, and doing his own thing. And I don't think The Killer is really quite misbegotten in the way that Next Goal Wins is. And, you know, maybe we'll talk more about that when it actually comes out. But it feels like both of these comebacks are going to kind of come and go. And then we'll still be really waiting to see what the next phase of his potential movie star career is going to be.
Yeah. I mean, I think when Next Goal Wins was originally supposed to come out in, what,
1997? Oh, yeah, something like that, yeah.
No, I'm kidding. But, like, I think there would have been less of a gap in his career had that movie come out closer to when it was filmed, right? Yeah.
But it's also such a light thing, you know? Yeah. It's like having waited so long to see that, I think, like, kind of hurts it expectations-wise. But he still is a movie star in some definition of the word, as damaged as that term is. And I don't feel like The Killer and Next Goal Wins kind of being quieter is going to affect that, but I feel like I'll still be waiting. Richard, speaking of things that you have reviewed or will be soon, you and I think every other critic has been very eager to get a look at The Curse, the Showtime series that has Nathan Fielder, Benny Safdie, and Emma Stone behind it. So in our, you know, strike-addled TV schedule, it's like a blockbuster. Like, it's like the biggest thing that we've seen in forever. I guess The Crown's right around the corner, maybe not that. Not that dramatic, but it does seem fascinating and like you would expect from something that Nathan Fielder and Benny Safdie had their hands in, divisive. And I think there are spoilers to be had, so I think we're going to try to keep pretty light on this. But where did you land on that divide?
Yeah, I absolutely, under strict embargo agreement, am not able to talk about how the season ends, so I won't. But yeah, I was very curious about it because of the people behind the camera, because of Emma Stone in front of the camera. She's also a producer on the show, but also because it has an HGTV connection. And I wrote a big feature for the magazine a couple years ago about my sort of obsession with home design shows and the phenomenon of those that, you know, extends past HGTV, but that's really the locus of all that. So I went in very curious, and it's not what I thought it was. I thought it was going to be much more of a, remember that Quibi show? Who was it? I think it was Caitlin Olson and somebody else.
Truly have no idea what you're talking about.
Oh, okay, sorry.
Is this one of those Quibis you dreamed, Richard?
Yeah, actually, maybe. Anyway, I thought it was going to be more satire parody kind of thing, though I, of course, should have expected something different from Fielder and Safdie. I am not a fan of Fielder's other shows. I find them to be, I know this just makes me kind of missing the point, but I find them to be sort of cruel in the way they involve real people. So I was more intrigued to see him do a scripted thing where he's playing a character. He and Emma Stone play a husband and wife who are trying to film a pilot in the beginning for an HGTV show, basically, that is about them descending on this small town in New Mexico, a very poor town located close to a indigenous Pueblo community, and try to make these very sustainable passive homes that are, you know, very basically have no carbon footprint. And it's about their vanity and their obtuseness in dealing with the local community. And it's really interesting. It's really cringy at times, like really uncomfortable to watch. Emma Stone is amazing in it. As the season goes, without revealing anything concrete, I think it loses a bit of its grasp on its argument and it's a little bit of its politics. I think that people, I have not read other reviews yet, but because I haven't written mine yet, but I think that people will take issue with, you know, how meta is the show? It's about these white people descending on this town and trying to understand them, but in a very self-centered way. Is the show itself, The Curse, also doing that? I don't know. I have to kind of think about that as I write about it, which is maybe why I've been putting off writing about it. But it's really intriguing, and there's a lot of great, like, filmmaking in it. And again, Emma Stone is really – I mean, Fielder's good too, but Emma Stone really stands out as this troubled real estate heiress who is trying to run away from her parents' bad reputation and be open and love and light and really understanding and use all the correct terms. And in so doing is just absolutely a bulldozer and does not really actually pay attention to anyone's actual humanity and needs. And I think that she really calibrates that character. So she's not a full cartoonish monster, but is instead a very recognizably human, shitty person, basically.
Does that feel like a familiar figure from your HGTV viewing? Like, that kind of feels like the closest it gets to a really direct parody there.
Yeah, I mean, something that one angle I pursued in writing that piece that we kind of had to jettison because it turned out that was going to be a whole other article, you know, maybe that one I could still write, but is that I did try to talk to some local activists from these various towns across America where an HGTV star couple has set up shop and tried to kind of remake towns or flip houses to better a neighborhood. You know, I was really curious to see what kind of impact that has on those communities, you know, negative or positive. The only people who wanted to talk to me about that were emphasizing the positive. Other people who I know have done work kind of advocating for like anti-gentrification stuff weren't really that interested in going on the record about it, which I understand. You know, people in Waco, Texas, where the Gaineses are. And the Gaineses, Chip and Joanna Gaines, I think are very much the core inspirations for this, just aged down a little bit. So it is a really interesting and troubling dynamic of how these shows function, what the difference between real life and reality TV is. And this show goes into that, but then it also spins off into a lot of strange, almost kind of metaphysical or supernatural directions that add a really interesting umami to the show. I just don't know as it goes if it kind of becomes clear that maybe they don't really know how to answer any of that suggestion. And if they want to actually address it concretely, no, I don't think they do. So that might leave people a little wanting as the series goes on. But it is, again, really intriguing to watch if, you know, kind of excruciatingly uncomfortable. I had to mute my screeners a couple times because I just could not bear to listen to what was happening in a scene.
I don't know if that's selling it exactly. That sounds like a challenge.
If you hear Emma Stone and Nathan Fielder do an HGTV comedy for Showtime, it's not probably going to be what people expect. It's an hour long. It's, I would say, maybe 60-40% drama to comedy. But there are some, there's a scene that goes from a normal human scene between husband and wife that then becomes something really calculated and grotesque and funny, and then becomes a genuinely bruising marital argument. And it's just carried through in one long sustained scene that is like one of the most striking things I've seen on TV this year. And so I think moments like that make it absolutely worth a watch. If you can, you know, if that sounds like fun to you, I say go for it.
Whew. What do we make of the fact that we were talking last week about Jodie Foster in True Detective, and then Robert Downey Jr. has got a Park Chan-wook show coming up. Emma Stone's in the thick of the Oscar race and also has this show coming. Like, I don't know how much of a blockbuster it's going to be if it's that physically painful to watch, but it can't hurt, right?
Yeah, I think it'll get attention. I mean, look, you know, Emma Stone made a great TV show a few years ago called, was it Maniac, right?
Yeah, Maniac.
And I don't know if that got a ton of it, the attention it deserved exactly. But thus far, Emma Stone has picked her TV projects very judiciously and I think smartly. Even if not everything works about either series, she remains, you know, we were talking about this with Emily Blunt last week in regard to Pain Hustlers. Like, Emma Stone really does elevate whatever she's in. And even though this is already pretty well pedigreed and elevated, like, she just makes it sing, you know, and it's exciting to see her do that. And also, you know, obviously, yeah, Poor Things is on its way. And I think she's going to be a tough figure to beat, maybe even in both Emmys and Oscars this year.
Oh, man. We'll have that conversation again shortly.
Yes.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
Well, we were talking about Emma Stone and her place in the Oscar race, and then I wanted to get into crafts, which leads me very easily to Poor Things. I kind of asked this all ahead of time to bring up a crafts category that has our interest for some reason in terms of who's competing in it. And I will take the opportunity to go first because I gave myself a segue. Because the minute I walked out of seeing Poor Things, I thought about how unfair it is that it has to compete against what I have been presuming is the front runner in that category, which is Barbie. And Rebecca, you had kind of brought up this idea for me first, maybe even before I saw Poor Things, that both of those films, along with other ones out there this year, just invent entire worlds out of whole cloth. And you know, in the case of Poor Things, you've got like a basis in some real cities, and Barbie also has like some elements of reality in there. But they're kind of both this like miraculous examples of production design and building something and creating their own reality. And I would prefer not to have to choose between them. Rebecca, did you come up with a favorite when you came up with this concept?
I have not come up with a favorite, but I think it's really cool to have these movies where you're sort of awestruck by the production design, because, you know, sometimes that can go unnoticed, but we're talking about movies where they're building entire worlds, and they're never quite reality, which I think is what makes them so interesting. You know, in Poor Things, you go to Lisbon and Paris and places we all know, but they're different. And to do that right is such a difficult balance. So I feel like that one is almost undeniable, but Barbie is such an unpredictable horse in this race, I think, that it makes for a really, really interesting competition.
I feel like it's been several years, too, since we had a production design winner that was just so thoroughly removed from reality. I mean, I guess Dune won, which is like pretty close in there, too. But like All Quiet on the Western Front won last year. And before that, it was Mank. And I think that ability to celebrate kind of like wild imagination that you get in this category more than maybe some others is a really special one. And maybe we'll get people to pay attention to this category who don't usually.
Well, since you've brought up Poor Things, I feel like I'm going to make the easy jump to costume design. Mm-hmm. While I think
back to Poor Barbie Things so soon.
Yes, but well, I
not necessarily.
All right, guys. Poor Things, I think, is a very strong competitor there as well. But what I'm more interested in is sort of the battle of the Jacquelines, which is such a nerdy thing to say. But so Jacqueline Duran did Barbie. You know, she has been nominated 8 times. She's won this category twice, for Anna Karenina and Little Women. And obviously, I think the costumes in Barbie are just that perfect balance that you recognize them from having Barbies or, you know, seeing those ads, but they're on these very famous actors. And just the way she pulled that off, I think, was really incredible. And then there's also Jacqueline West, who did Killers of the Flower Moon. I had an interview with her on the podcast, and I'm just like shocked that she's never won. She's been nominated 4 times, Dune, The Revenant, Curious Case of Benjamin Button, among them, but she hasn't won. And I think what she had to do with Killers of the Flower Moon to really be authentic with, especially dressing the Osage people in the film, was a really tough task. And they were very smart about bringing in artisans from the community to help out with that. And it was her first time working with Scorsese, and I think they really pulled something special off there. So I feel like for my predicting, I'll just write Jacqueline and then just not write a last name, and I'll probably be right. So,
David, you want to go next?
Sure. For me, film editing is very interesting this year for a couple of reasons. One, the branch very rarely nominates non-Best Picture nominees. Like in the last 5 years, I believe the only one is Tick, Tick, Boom, which if you think about all the films that have very showy editing, that is not probably the first one you'd pick of kind of outlier nominee. So they tend to surprise. And this year, it's pretty top-heavy in terms of Best Picture contenders, but I wonder if a movie like Ferrari, since they love Vroom Vroom movies in this category, like Ford v. Ferrari won and Top Gun Maverick was nominated, can make its way in, or even a movie like The Killer, to go back to David Fincher, who always crafts his movies very exactingly. And then the second reason is the branch really embraces more than other branches, like comedy and flow here, inevitably, because that's a huge part of editing. Like Don't Look Up was nominated here, for example. And so, you know, where do movies like Poor Things and The Holdovers and Barbie, how do they stack up against movies like Oppenheimer, which I think is an overwhelming frontrunner here, just given the, you know, the feat of putting all of that together in such a, you know, riveting package. Or Killers of the Flower Moon, Thelma was nominated for The Irishman, and this movie has great momentum. I feel like the branch will embrace her here. Or An Anatomy of a Fall, where the editing is very visible. Like, I'm just curious how, like, on which side they'll land a little bit more heavy, because there's a lot of really interesting and unique work here, and they tend to lean one way or the other.
If Oppenheimer won Best Editing, it would be posthumous, right? Because surely no one could survive that, right? Like, that's like, you do a month on that and that's it. You're done.
Five people, they had kept having to replace them to finish the movie.
Yeah, I think, that's a question. I mean, I'm not an expert in editing, but like, I guess if you wanted to be really like basic and sort of like broad overview of it, you have an Oppenheimer that's like certainly most editing, and then something else like you're describing, David, where people in the branch, like, who really get the craft are like, well, here's this other movie that really seamlessly, you know, blends these different takes together.
And that's definitely a jump from the nominating phase to the winner phase, because I don't think Bohemian Rhapsody would have won Best Editing if the editing branch were voting. I would like to think that it would not have won.
Bohemian Rhapsody, the only movie I can think of that became a meme for bad editing.
For like, editing.
But, not to judge these movies, I don't think the branch made great choices that year. That category had Bohemian Rhapsody, Green Book, and Vice as 3 of the 5 nominees, which is, again, the point of them maybe leaning toward the lighter side of things, let's say. But it can vary. I do think that once it comes down to everybody voting, Oppenheimer is so immediately and intensely cut together. Like, you just, even people with the most basic knowledge of editing, understanding of editing, can understand what that movie is doing in that department.
And it's such a hallmark of Nolan's films, you know, that sort of Nicholas Roeg inspired, you know, quick cut kind of like thing. And to execute that over 3 hours with so many different things to juggle, like, it is a feat. It's, you know, it wouldn't just kind of like roll with a Best Picture win. Like, it would be an earned award.
Yeah, I agree. And I think especially because it's far more introspective than his other movies, it requires a level of finesse in that department in terms of what he always does. And it doesn't lean on the typical draggy biopic flashback structure that a lot of films use. It is more immediate. It's more visceral, and I think a lot more effective.
Richard, you want to close us out with her crafts?
Yeah, I was gonna. I don't think it'll win anything, but I think the cinematography in Zone of Interest. I hope that gets recognized at least. Mm-hmm. That's Łukasz Zal, another in the long great tradition of Polish cinematographers. He's young. He's a little older than me, barely, but. I think that the argument against Zone of Interest would be like, well, it's mostly just like a bright garden and then these static fixed cameras in this house where, you know, the people weren't even in the room, really. The filmmakers weren't, you know, like how much actual work is going into that. But there's so much thought, you know, collaboration between Zal and Jonathan Glazer that, like, I think it the look of that film is one of the big things that sells the horror of it. It's a kind of a study in contrast in a way. And then you get these moments at the very end of the film where darkness does descend in a real way, in a tangible way. And then it kind of takes on a different sort of visual vernacular, you know. And I just think it's subtler work maybe, but it's really, really strong and helps make that film as immersive and consuming as it is.
Do we think that cinematography, like editing, is going to be so heavily leaned toward Oppenheimer? Does it feel like there's more competition in that one?
Well,
I mean, yeah, I don't know. I think it's hard to say with these things what gets swept up. I mean, cinematography, you know, like other prizes, like they don't always just follow suit, you know. But I think when you have a juggernaut like Poor Things in all of these technical categories, it might be sort of hard to deny, you know, and that might be mean that other smaller films lose out on a chance to get their one, you know, distinguishing award. But I don't know. It kind of feels like it's an Oppenheimer versus Poor Things to me. Although I'm seeing on Gold Derby, as I just opened that now, that Barbie is ranked pretty high for a lot of people.
I think Rodrigo Prieto's a major story this season. I mean, I would think he's probably more likely to win for Killers of the Flower Moon and more likely to be nominated for that as well. But once he gets to a certain phase, if he is nominated for one or both, there could definitely be an argument for him to go pretty far because he's a beloved cinematographer. He's been working with Scorsese for a long time, and he now has two of the most, you know, two of the biggest movies of the year, and they both look amazing.
This is controversial because obviously there was a lot of furor over Bradley Cooper's nose, and I understand that, and I'm not endorsing it or unendorsing it. But beyond the nose, I do think the aging makeup in Maestro is pretty incredible. Mm-hmm. The way that the film opens on older Bernstein, and it's Bradley Cooper, recognizably, you know, prosthetic nose or not, but everything else, the skin tone, the kind of liver spots, the hair, it's all so carefully done that he really does look like what Bradley Cooper might look like in 30 years, you know, and ditto too for the work that that they do with Carey Mulligan. And, you know, I don't know that maybe the controversy over the prosthetics is just too much to even suggest that, but I do think that there is really careful, impressive work there.
I think it's going to do well. I would call it the front runner to win, actually. I think the branch will really respond to it, even if it is a talking point, you know, by people who want to have it be a talking point.
I wonder if it's going to even remain a talking point once people see this movie that we've been talking about for months now.
So. Because that magic trick is so impactful, right? Like you get used to it so quickly because of how effective the makeup is.
The point is also notable because last year we were talking about this category versus Best Actor, Elvis versus the Whale, the front runners in both. It can match up. Tammy Faye, it also won both.
Yeah.
So, that's probably a point in his favor if it does go far here.
I said an interesting case for Priscilla and Kaylee Spaney, who's a Best Actress contender we keep debating, but Priscilla has so much makeup and visual impact in it, much like Elvis did, and you wonder if they could go hand in hand as well.
You think about Meryl Streep thanking her longtime makeup person when she won for Iron Lady. Every single film in between.
If there is one area where I hope Priscilla does find some traction, it is there. Because the movie was made on a really tight budget for what it is. And Sofia Coppola, working with a mix of people that she's worked with for a long time and new collaborators. And it's such a study in a director who knows how to get what she wants, who is both a perfectionist and someone who can be a little bit spontaneous on set and improvise as need be. pulling everything together to do something really special and really significant with not a lot of resources.
That does it for this week's show. We will be back next week. Find us in the meantime at vanityfair.com, on social media platforms at VF Awards Insider, and you can track me down at Katie Rich and Richard.
Rylaws.
And David.
David Canfield 97.
And Rebecca.
Becca M. Ford.
Our editor and producer is Brett Fuchs, and this week's award for the best description of something Joaquin Phoenix probably does in Napoleon goes to Richard Lawson.
Bury a dead horse.
I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
Do you ever see a new face or name on your news feeds and say, who the heck is that?
Our podcast, Who Weekly, is everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't. Think of us as your cheat code to People Magazine, your glossary for Hollywood, a shortcut to understanding pop culture at large.
For the past 8 years, Who Weekly has been telling listeners everything they need to know about the celebrities they don't. The New Yorker says we spelunk deep into the demimonde with convivial delight. That's a direct quote.
Mostly, we're going to explain to you Irish star Barry Keoghan's sudden rise to fame and relationship with a not-so-under-the-radar pop princess named Sabrina.
The fake wedding Real Housewives star Cynthia Bailey had to promote a limo rental company.
And why all the Gen Zers you know are talking about a guy named Benson Boone.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we answer the most burning celebrity queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly, an Odyssey podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.